From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, now that Speaker Paul Ryan won't seek re-election, what does that mean for a Republican hopeful in his district?
Ryan, as a candidate, had both the advantages of incumbency and long-term success in the district, as well as an immense fundraising advantage. Now, those two things will be gone.
Then Wauwatosa writer Tom Matthews talks about his new novel, Raising the Dead.
Plus, we learn about the pipe organ music of 20th century composer Olivier Messiaen.
It's really very spiritual, and if you let it, it can transport you far, far away. Sometimes I play a concert and I have no idea where I've been or what I did, because it's very moving.
And Bubbler Talk finds out what the deal is with that large tower in Estabrook Park. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Since House Speaker Paul Ryan announced this past Wednesday that he would not run for re-election, the result of Wisconsin's first congressional district race this fall has become much less certain.
For the first time in two decades, it's an open seat. With no incumbent having built-in name recognition or an advantage in fundraising, the race promises to be interesting. And Marquette Law School poll Director Charles Franklin says it's likely to be a more competitive race as well.
Franklin spoke with WUWM's Marty Michelson and said that Ryan's announcement did surprise him.
There have certainly been rumors that this might be coming, and perhaps people more plugged in than I am would have seen those rumors as really reflecting something that would happen. I was more surprised because of the historical precedent. It's very, very rare for a speaker to retire in the midst of an election cycle. Either they've stayed in office and run for re-election and then retired shortly after the new Congress takes office, or they've retired before the election year even begins. So in these ways, I think it was especially surprising to me from that historical perspective.
What will be Paul Ryan's legacy?
That will be interesting to see, because as a champion of cuts to entitlement programs and as a champion of balancing or improving the deficit, you'd have to say that he's not achieved those two things, with the most recent estimates that trillion-dollar deficits are now looming after the Republican tax plan and budget were passed in the last few months. Certainly that doesn't fit with the balanced budget goal that he had. Further, while he's put entitlement reforms, especially Medicare and to some extent Social Security, on the policy agenda, he's failed to see those bills move forward through the Congress with a serious chance of passage. So in those ways, I think his legacy is one of aspiration, and yet he was unable to convince even his own Republican majority to follow through on those. On the more positive side, he stepped into the role of Speaker at a time that the House Republican Party was in immense disarray, having just ousted John Boehner. And he soothed the waters in the House to some extent and has managed through the 2017 year and now part of 2018 to keep the House relatively under control, in contrast to some of the difficulties that Boehner particularly had with a very divided Republican delegation to Congress.
With Paul Ryan out, what does this mean for the race for the first district?
Well, it certainly opens the race more to a competitive election. Ryan, as a candidate, had both the advantages of incumbency and long-term success in the district, as well as an immense fundraising advantage. Now, those two things will be gone. What's still there is a district that has typically been between 10 and 14 points more Republican than the state as a whole. And so that Republican tilt of the district remains even if Ryan's gone. Democrats have geared up to a much more serious campaign this year with better fundraising and better candidates' visibility than had been the case in previous races for the district. And Republicans now have a short time frame to get into the race and put together a campaign. So I think those things make the race more competitive than it normally would be. In a year that's likely to favor Democrats nationally, that probably makes the race competitive or no better than lean Republican as opposed to a likely or safe Republican rating for the race.
What factors will be in play now in terms of money spent and national interest in the race?
I think, first of all, we've seen Randy Brice in particular on the Democratic side with a very strong fundraising performance and fairly strong national visibility. An irony may be that with the speaker no longer the target of the race, some of the national attention might actually dissipate a little bit on Democratic side as it becomes just another open seat campaign. The other side depends on how the Republicans deal with this, and do they nominate a single establishment candidate, or do we end up with a bitterly contested primary with multiple candidates from different factions of the party? And it's way too early to tell how that's going to turn out at this stage.
Do you think there will be a line of Republicans scrambling to run for the seat? And would GOP candidates have to be well-financed going in and pretty much ready-made?
Being well-financed and already having won elections within the district is an advantage in every race. And so if there are elected officials with good war chests and fundraising apparatus, then that will certainly be an advantage to getting in. I think that the Republican tilt of the district means it's an attractive race for a Republican candidate who thinks if they could win it this year, they could hold on to it in the future. So for those reasons, I think it is attractive to ambitious Republicans, even if they think this year is going to be a tough, hard-fought campaign.
With Paul Ryan out, how might this impact the Wisconsin governor's race?
I think that the direct effect of the governor's race is probably not too strong. If it means that the first district is not as reliable a reservoir of Republican votes because the first district campaign is tight, then maybe that's a little bit of bad news for the governor. I'm more struck by how the three prominent Republicans of Ryan, Reince Priebus, and Scott Walker is now reduced to just one, Walker. We've seen that period when three people from Wisconsin were at high ranks of the Republican Party, and now that has changed, and we're down to only Scott Walker at this point.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He spoke with WUWM's Marty Michelson.
Coming up after a break, we talk with Wauwatosa writer Tom Matthews about his new novel, Raising the Dad. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Yesterday on the show, we featured a new novel by a Wisconsin writer featuring a family whose difficult husband and father suddenly dies, then turns out not to be dead. The book explores how the protagonist and other members of the family process that development.
Our next guest is also a Wisconsin writer with a new novel featuring a family whose difficult father and husband suddenly dies and then turns out not to be dead. And this book, too, explores how the protagonist and his family process that development.
But for as similar as the plots sound, they're actually quite different books. Wauwatosa writer Tom Matthews is the author of Raising the Dad, which is at turns funny, dark, and thought-provoking. He talked about the novel with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.
So how do we feel about spoilers? We can talk about the basic premise here, right?
Right, yeah.
Oh, so there's a big development that happens. It's probably about 40 pages into this book, and I don't think we can talk about it without explaining what's going on. So
right.
John Husted is your hero.
Mm-hmm.
Husted.
Yeah.
He is living what sounds like a pretty standard, if unexciting, middle-age experience in a southern Wisconsin city. What else should we know about John as the book opens?
Well, let me back up a little bit, because this is sort of rooted very loosely in my story. My father was a doctor down in Beloit, where I was born. He died of a heart attack when I was 10, which was traumatic in all the ways you'd imagine. Jump forward about 15 years, and I have this dream. And in the dream, a doctor friend of my father's comes to me, and gravely tells me he has to tell me something. He takes me into this very sparse room, and there is my father, silent and stilled by a devastating system failure, beyond any kind of communication or engagement, but he's alive. And I found that enormously profound. It just really affected me. Just to be in the same room with him and touch his warm skin and know you're breathing the same air, it really, really, in a way no other dream ever has, really stuck with me.
Things diverge a little bit in the book, though, because
yes.
John is somewhat further along in life, a little further along when his father dies, but much further along when this, you know, shocking truth
right.
comes to him.
Right. Jump forward another 20 years. I'm starting a graduate writing program at Mary. I just need a something to write in the story. So I remember this dream. I tried a short story. It goes well. It strikes a really nice balance between really deep emotion but also unexpected sort of mordant humor. My next semester is a novel writing class. I don't think I can sustain this really wildly seemingly implausible premise across a book, but I figure I'll take a shot. That also feels good. It becomes my thesis project. It's a book. But that is the premise. This man who has a fairly typical dysfunctional family life suddenly, remarkably, is made aware of the fact that the father they all thought had been dead for decades is alive in this silent state. He has to decide if they can even know about what he knows and maintain the family. So that is his burden.
You say the family is on the verge of collapse. His mom is dealing with the onset of dementia. He has a teenage daughter who is turning into a teenage daughter. He has a brother who's just gotten out of jail. And he has a marriage that it sounds like, just from your portrayal, is not catastrophically horrible, but, you know, the kind of death by a thousand paper cuts model.
It's going cold. So there's just a lot of relationships that are not uncommon, but all things that he has to take into account as he has to move forward with this surprise that's been given to him.
Speaking as someone who every once in a while has some strange dreams, a lot has to happen to give them any kind of narrative arc. Can you talk about this process, you know, of turning it into first a short story and then a novel, you know, going from this single idea to wading in through the kind of complex social issues that are also touched on by this situation?
Yeah, the dream touched me because I think I had, and I think probably still do, a fairly pragmatic view of a life that has fallen into this condition. I think it's time to let them go. They're not serving a purpose, so to speak. But I realized in the dream there was something profound there. And it really sort of, I say sometimes it sort of makes an end-of-life statement I'm not sure I agree with. But I think that's what makes it interesting. And I also think, without giving anything away, by the end of the book, the father has kind of healed this family without ever doing anything. Just his presence helps. So that was kind of the thing pulling me forward. And it also was just this very bizarre circumstance of this guy. He's also, my research told me it's not that amazing that you could sustain a life that long if you just commit to this very relentless care. You know, Terry Schiavo lived for 15 years and could still be alive if they hadn't been all that court stuff. So I had to do a lot of work to sort of sell the premise. But the fact is, it just falls on John's head to sustain his father's care going forward, financially, emotionally. There's a spot where the father is, which almost becomes another character in the story. And also, what I really liked about it is John, just by necessity, spends a lot of time in solitude at his father's bedside and starts mulling over his life with his father, who he doesn't really remember.
He's stunned to find out that his father was really kind of a funny guy.
Yeah. Yeah, the father was, you know, a very successful doctor, but way too committed to his job. He wasn't close to his son.
How much of that is pulled from your own experience?
My father was kind of a mover and shaker in the hospital scene in Beloit, and he was working a lot. And when he was home, he was in his den working some more. And I wish I had more memory of him. But he also, like my father, who I can still go down to Beloit and meet people who were his patients or work for him, and he's just revered down there. But there's part of me saying, you know, am I getting the whole story? I would love to really learn more about my father and maybe even learn some things that aren't so flattering. And John, again, just because he has all this time on his hands, starts learning about his father and learns something about him that is troubling, but it humanizes his father in a way that would never have happened if this hadn't all been given to him.
One of the things that hit me as I was reading this and kind of considering the implications of what John is going through in the story is a lot of us think of these end-of-life issues, the Terry Schiavo case, for example, a very, very famous example, as really ethical and political sorts of issues. And at the same time, for the people who are most connected to them, John in this case, he has to think about it in those terms, but he also has to consider it in very personal, very emotional terms.
Yeah, yeah. Part of it is financial. The only other person who knows is his wife, who is kind of a voice of, you know, she provides the straight talk when John won't really confront some of the things he has to confront. But financially, this is a burden. In terms of his career, it's a burden. He starts screwing up with his job because of this. Again, it's just a relentless care that this his father needs. And it's also just, how can you not bring this news to your mother and your brother? But briefly, the mother, because of her dementia, quite possibly could not emotionally handle the news. And John's brother is this very sketchy person.
Let's talk about John's brother here, because we've had you on the show any number of times in your work as a rock writer. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of the heavy metal scene in northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin from about the last 30 years that makes its way into this. That had to be a little bit enjoyable to write.
Well, I knew Mike, the brother, is a very unpleasant person. And I knew that I needed, not just for my reader, but for me, I just had to find something, not that I liked about him, but at least was interesting. I am a ravenous reader of rock and roll memoirs. The shabbier, the better. So I was reading, it was either Slash of Guns N' Roses or Nikki Sixx of Motley Crue.
Famed authors that both
of
them are.
Yes, men of letters, at least tattoos.
Yeah.
But I was reading one of those, and that's it. Mike was an aspiring heavy metal singer. Actually, for the craft he was pursuing, was very, very good at it, but he also got drawn into the lifestyle. And having signed a major label contract, his life immediately blew up, and that's his backstory, is he had a taste of the fame, and now he's just a sad, figure who John worries that Mike would recognize that having the father back is really just something to exploit for a lawsuit. Mike would not, because Mike and the father hated each other up until the time the father died, quote unquote. And that's the other dilemma, that John doesn't know if he can trust his brother to be as moved by this as he is. So there are two very credible reasons for maybe John should just let this end and never tell them. But that's just, how do you do that? So, yeah, it's complicated.
How hard was this book to pitch?
Well, it took about twice as long to sell as it took to write. I am fortunate to have a good stream of credentials where I was able to get it to a lot of agents, but they all passed, and I knew why, because it's a strange mix of really deeply, I hope, moving sentiment, but also it's got Mike. Mike ends up a singer in a Motley Crue tribute band. So it's, you try to sell that and, you know, these other issues, and it's tricky.
Not a ton of books set in a fictionalized Beloit, Wisconsin, either,
right.
I wouldn't imagine.
Yeah, yeah. So it was, I finished it, I think, late 2011, and I didn't sell it until 3 years ago, and it's been sitting at the publisher for 3 years. So yeah. But for reasons if they can't, especially now, if it can't be very cleanly slotted into some pigeonhole, there aren't a lot of takers. So I just resolved to not give up and finally got it done. But it was, if you go back to this dream I had, it's been 30 years.
Wow. But it has a home, it has a major publisher, and it's going to be on bookshelves in the next few weeks.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I've had one novel previously published, but it was a small publisher, and honestly, I don't think it made it into many stores at all, except locally, just through my efforts. So it will be nice to actually get it on the shelves and just again, from the spark of an idea that turned into just a homework assignment to this thing that sort of consumed my life for a long time. It'll just be nice to see it between covers and on the shelves.
You have any other dreams that are sitting out there waiting for waiting for a treatment, optioned?
This truly was. I have a very, very, very vivid dream life, but this was the one that really, really felt like something someday it was going to have its shot. So here it is.
Well, Tom Matthews, I think we can all be grateful. It's great stuff. Thank you so much, and again, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Wauwatosa novelist and occasional Lake Effect essayist Tom Matthews' new book is called Raising the Dad. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke, and the two of them will reprise their conversation Tuesday evening on stage at Boswell Book Company.
Coming up next, we'll learn about the pipe organ music of 20th century French composer Olivier Messiaen. That's coming up when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The sound of a pipe organ can literally rumble the floor beneath your feet. The sounds they make can be grand and imposing, or delicate and intimate, or something in between. It all depends on the combination of stops, keyboards, and foot pedals the music calls for.
And at the Church of the Jesu on West Wisconsin Avenue, there are 4 keyboards, at least 40 stops, a full footboard, as well as 20 foot stops to choose from.
Sound engineer Jason Reavy and I traveled the 12 blocks from the studio to the choir loft at Jesu to meet Dean Roscoe, the principal organist at the church, and John Gillick, an internationally acclaimed soloist and specialist in the organ music of 20th century French composer Olivier Messiaen. Gillick began by performing a piece that mimics birdsong. Can you tell me what it is that we just heard?
That's the song of a musician thrush. And this piece by Messiaen called Verset, which was written in 1960, is about a 10-minute piece that's centered around two major solos of this bird. And I don't know if you know that Messiaen not only was a musician, but he was also an ornithologist. These are real transcriptions of bird songs, not just made up.
Not just a musician's fancy of what they were.
That's exactly right.
That is quite amazing. And to hear it on this organ, too, you know, we're sitting with you here on the bench, and there are four keyboards, there are pedals, there are various push pedals, as well as stops all over the place. But that was just on the one keyboard.
That's right. Well, a bird only has one timbre, doesn't it?
I suppose it does, yeah.
And I was once told that birds don't sing with rubato either. So that's an important thing to remember when interpreting Messiaen's birds. They're full of all kinds of touch marks, which means that the birds have different ways of attacking and releasing, but no rubato, or very little.
So, Dean, when this was all coming together, how did you feel about getting John to come and perform here?
That's a wonderful opportunity.
Well, we should say you are the church organist, is that correct? Yes. So normally you're sitting at this bench.
Correct.
How is it hearing him?
It's fascinating to me to hear everybody's interpretation of the instrument. We run an active concert series here, so to hear different approaches to the organ and the instrument I sit before every week has totally different personalities. And to have a chance to hear a master interpreter of such a noted composer is a really wonderful opportunity for me and for everyone.
Well, we should talk a little bit about the instrument that we are sitting in front of and standing in front of. This is a good example of a type of organ, and I know anyone who's gone to church has seen a pipe organ, but this has some extra things, is that correct?
For a church organ, it's to the large side. It's the largest pipe organ in the state of Wisconsin, just by metric, and It's got a lot more variety is what that amounts to than your average church organ, certainly. Yeah.
And so when you talk about variety, you're talking about sounds it can make?
Correct. Yeah. Different orchestral qualities, strings, reeds, clarinets, trumpet sounds, tuba sounds, all of those sorts of good things.
Could you give me a sample of what, say, a reed sound?
Well, there are many, many kinds of reeds. Here's a clarinet. Eight-foot pitches, and then you add the 16s and eighths, and these are all different kinds of reeds.
And when you talk about the 16s and the eighths, you're talking about that's the length of pipe that is being sounded?
That's the length of pipe that's being sounded, but it also tells you what octave it's being played in.
Okay.
Eight-foot pitch is what you hear when you play any note on the piano. Then 4-foot pitch automatically adds the octave above that, and 16-foot pitch adds the octave below that, and 32-foot pitch adds the octave below that.
And I understand that this organ has three 32 pitches?
There are three full-length 32-foot extensions in this organ, yes.
And that's rare.
It's rare to have one. Yes.
So I'm sorry, John, we're going to have to hear the deep ones. I I think we just blew out our sound equipment. That is amazing. So that's contrabombard.
Yes.
And then there's a contraviolon.
So that adds the purring underneath.
You hear the air. Yeah.
It just supports the whole organ and adds richness and warmth. And
that's beautiful. And then there was one more, and that's the contrabourdon. Similar.
But quieter. And with less pitch definition.
Okay. And so was Messiaen one of the people that used those deep tones?
Oh, absolutely.
I know Franck did, and I know Bach did.
Well, that's a part of the organ. It's an inescapable part of the organ.
But not all composers ventured that far.
Well, it depends on their style and what they want, but in any kind of full organ sound, it's always wonderful to have the 32, but many organs don't have it.
So 16 is the farthest they go?
Nearly any organ would have a 16-foot, but 32-foot, no.
And so, Dean, I understand this organ was refurbished not too long ago, within the last 10 years.
Yes, in 2011. Yeah.
So what was done to it?
The whole instrument was removed in its entirety and taken to the Schanz Organ Company factory in Orville, Ohio. Everything was renewed and refurbished, reconditioned to like new condition. The console is new. All the mechanism is new. There are a lot of heritage pipes, a lot of old pipes in the organ, the oldest of which date back to 1886. So 9 builders' work is represented in the sounds you hear in this organ, ranging from 1886 in Johnson Organ Company all the way to 2011 in Schanz Organ Company. So there's a pretty wide variety of eras represented as well in terms of organ building. So with each era, you get a different philosophy, but Schanz did a masterful job in blending them all together and making it not only a cohesive, but a brilliant ensemble.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. It's like you've got a century of difference in terms of metals, mm-hmm. things have aged differently,
yes,
people
absolutely.
Build things differently, and how to make it all sound like one instrument.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a lot of 1895 Kimball in this instrument, which was the original instrument this present one is based off of. And there's a lot of 1955 Kilgan. The Kilgan Organ Company undertook the last really major renovation of this instrument in 1955. So there's a lot of their work represented in this instrument as well.
And John, I have to ask, to me it's similar to a pianist. Every time you sit down at a new organ, it's like, yes, you know the instrument, but it's a brand new instrument to you. Does it take time to get comfortable with it?
It takes a long time to get to know any instrument really well. It's always frustrating to arrive and have to give a concert in a few days and not really know the organ, and that only comes with time.
Yes, you get to learn its idiosyncrasies.
Well, yeah. How the stops combine with one another and what really makes the most beautiful sounds. That's not an easy job, and you have to listen very carefully.
When you talk about what stops combine, that's not dictated by the music? The composer doesn't tell you
In most French organ music, yes, it's written in. But that registration, the selection of stops, will only work on the instrument that it was written for. So it's the interpreter's job to find out how best to adapt that to another organ. And that's not always easy either.
Would you mind giving us a little demonstration of something else very different from the bird songs, just so we can hear some of the other colors and timbres of the organ?
Well, I don't know how much you want to hear, but the bird songs are surrounded by plain song.
Okay.
Which is very interesting. And the beginning has 3 sections. It begins with the Alleluia for the feast of the dedication of a church, all alone on the clarinet. And that's answered by some soft stops on another manual. And then the melody comes in the pedal on a flute 4-foot, accompanied by the strings. And he calls that to be played like a lullaby. And then that is answered by a 3rd section on very soft stops. And he says that is the consolation.
Thank you so much. And I'm looking at the music over your shoulder as you're performing that and thinking, that is very complicated. You studied with him, did you not?
Yes, I did.
That must have helped so much when you were starting to work on his pieces.
Well, I'll tell you, I learned all of Messiaen's organ works before I ever met him. And at the end of the period of doing that, I did it in a year, which is very fast, I felt like I knew the man. And yet, the stories that I heard from all of my contemporaries was just the opposite. So I wanted to go study with him to find out if I was right. And I met him in New York in 1976, and he invited me to come and be a member of his class as his friend. And so I went, and I found out I absolutely knew who he was. He's a true musician, and just like all true artists, they can only reveal themselves in their works, not something they aren't.
What did your contemporaries say about him that was so...
They thought he was crazy, said he'd been in an insane asylum and all sorts of weird things. But it's funny how people get stories mixed up, because it's actually a very sad story, because when Messiaen came back from the war, you know, he was a prisoner of war in the Second World War, and he wrote his quartet for the End of Time while he was in captivity. But when he came back, he found his wife, Claire Delbos, was losing her mind. And for the next 20 years, he was more or less taking care of her. And they had a young son. And for the last 10 years of her life, or about that, she was in a home. And during the 50s, she died in 1959. He wrote practically no music.
So you're here, and Dean, I'm going to bring you in on this as well. You're here as part of the American Guild of Organists.
It's primarily through their efforts that we're able to present this on Sunday. A master class is happening on Friday where various students and performers will have the opportunity to come and perform the music of Messiaen and gather Mr. Gillick's thoughts about the music, their interpretation of it. It's a neat opportunity, a really nice opportunity to be able to do that.
And then we hear a performance by you on Sunday, is that correct?
Yes. And preceding that, there's also a panel discussion, I think, about Messiaen, which could interest a lot of people, a nice introduction to people that don't know his music. On first hearing, a lot of people may find his music very strange, but it's funny. He considered his music to be modern, but he said it's also very romantic. And in all of his music, once you get to know it, you know, that's the essence of it. But the other essence of it is that it's really very spiritual. And if you let it, it can transport you to far, far away. Sometimes I play a concert and I have no idea where I've been or what I did, because it's very moving.
Can you leave us with a little something of his that moves you?
Well, I think it's always the quiet pieces that are most moving, but the loud ones are overwhelming, and that makes the quiet ones even more special when they come. This is a very, well, all Messiaen pieces are very special, but the suite I'm playing on Sunday is about Christmas, is about the birth of Christ, and so this one is about the shepherds. I'll play the statement, simple, loud, and then I'll play the echo, ornamented and quiet. How's that?
That sounds perfect. And before you do, I just want to say thank you for taking time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Dean Roscoe is the principal organist at the Church of the Jesu on the Marquette campus. John Gillick is an internationally renowned organist specializing in the music of 20th century French composer Olivier Messiaen.
Gillick performs a concert of Messiaen's organ music this Sunday at 3 at the Church of the Jesu. There's more information at wuwm.com.
One last break, and then Bubbler Talk finds out what the deal is with the large tower in Estabrook Park. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
This week's question involves the large metal tower here at the entrance to Esterbrook Park near the border of Milwaukee and Shorewood. The listener wanted to know just what the structure is and why it's here. Well, I know a bit of the answer because this tower houses WUWM's antenna along with WITI Channel 6 and a couple other radio stations, but I fall short on technical details, so I asked our studio engineer, Jason Reavy, to tell me more.
Hi, how are you today? Good.
Normally, we see each other in WUWM's offices in downtown Milwaukee, but this morning we met outside the small building connected to the looming tower.
Well, being that our offices and station is located down at Chase Tower, basically everything is produced in Chase Tower. We have a system that goes up to the roof, blasts it over to the tower here.
Jason unlocked the door of the transmitter building and we headed inside.
Well, this is all the broadcast equipment to get the signal back up out of the antenna.
It was kind of hard to hear him because of all the noise from the fans.
The transmitters in here, they put out a lot of heat. So we have fans and stuff in here to suck the heat out of the room, because if it gets over a certain temperature, you can damage the transmitters and a lot of the other equipment that's in here, and then we're off the air, and that's no good.
After the quick tour, Jason armed the security system, and we headed outside.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Absolutely, yeah.
We'll see you back down there.
Yep, sounds good.
But our Bubbler Talk listener didn't just want to know what the tower does, but why it's in this exact location at the entrance to a Milwaukee County park.
WITI, the owner of the tower, had a very small footprint of land where they had to place this tower.
That's former WUWM chief engineer Tom May. He worked for WUWM from 2000 to 2013.
The location that they had to go in was right there in the corner of Esterbrook Park on Capitol Drive.
Tom says the FCC gives precise instructions to tower builders. He says when WITI built the tower in 1962, WITI had to build in that exact location so its signal wouldn't interfere with a different Channel 6 elsewhere.
Having your tower located in one spot versus 2 miles down the road or a half a mile down the road can be the difference between being able to put out a 100,000-watt signal and a 25,000-watt signal.
The way our Bubbler Talk questioner phrased the inquiry implied that the tower is a bit of an eyesore. But Tom sees things differently, and he's not alone. There are web pages and articles devoted to the tower because of its design.
For a while, it was the tallest freestanding object in the world at 1,088 feet. There's not very many that are this height that do not have guy wires in the world.
And WITI celebrated the structure, decorating the length of it with lights. WITI also worked a drawing of the tower into a Channel 6 logo, and for years had a huge number 6 hanging from its side. So is the tower something to celebrate as an engineering marvel and a part of local broadcast history? Or is it a structure that mars the appearance of one of the area's green spaces? The two sides may never agree, but if they like turning on the radio and listening to WUWM, they have something in common. The tower is broadcasting the signal that they've listened to, as it has for decades.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
We have some time for music to end the show today. Local band Various Small Fires recently took over the performance studio and part of the hallway outside of the studio to perform some songs for us. Here they are with their original tune, Shine.
You need on your face is a kind of reply. Dirt under your feet as you point your head up to the sky. And you're gonna move on up, take your place. that your life, what rises is about to converge, and you're gonna move on up, take your place at the table, and you're gonna show your stuff till everybody knows your name. Shine, shine, I'll give you a taste of it. Shine, shine, you're gonna work on it. Shine, shine, oh boy, you better make it shine.
Various Small Fires with their song Shine. The band performs Saturday night at the Up and Under on Brady Street.
They're part of the Battle of the Bands competition for a slot on the local band stage for this year's Summerfest. And that takes us to the end of Friday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Mitch Tyke and Audrey Nowakowski, intern Claudia Delgadillo, and reporter Susan Bentz.
Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor, and Jason Reavy is our audio engineer. Thanks to Willie Porter for the theme music, and thanks to you for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for another edition of Lake Effect Weekend.
It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUW. WWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned, Fresh Air is next.